So before we start talking about the voyage home, I wanted to make a correction from last week. You may or may not know that Richard primarily does trek about while on extremely powerful psychotropic drugs.
Yes.
And often he does not pick up salient points from previous episodes of Trek About that I am laying down.
I don't need salient because I wear glasses, not contacts.
Ah. So last week we talked about the remember situation from Search for Spock and Wrath of Khan. I was saying, well, you should probably like, and you know, honestly, I could have been a little clearer as well. I will take some responsibility
you
here.
You should have been clearer on this.
But, you know, basically, the remember stuff was a direct link to the forget at the end of Requiem for Methuselah when Spock made his friend Jim forget his love.
Which episode was Requiem for Methuselah?
That was the one where Spock was really interested in Brahms.
No, I can't say I remember it.
Okay. Well, anyway. And the point I was trying to make is that, you know, one of Richard's criticisms of Star Trek so far has been its sort of lack of interest in any sort of continuity, remembering what happened in previous episodes. And if there's one thing you can say about the original series movies, I think that they have very much been about bringing continuity into the franchise. And I was just curious to see if Richard had any thoughts about linking the remember and forget stuff.
Well, I think it was cool.
At this point, it doesn't matter.
Oh.
So be quiet.
Okay.
But, well, I just wanted to explain that. No, I said be quiet. You can talk now. I don't know. Do you have anything to say about that?
Not really. I mean, I would have last week, but, you know, maybe you should have led me to the point a little better.
Yeah.
See, I think let's take an action item from this meeting. I think that every week you should prepare a list of notes for me. Talking points and, you know, callbacks and things that I should know.
I'll consider this.
It'll have, like, spellings and names of characters.
I won't do it.
Because I warn you, this week I'm going to talk about the marine biologist a lot.
But I'll consider it. Well, let's talk about the marine biologist by moving into Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Which, right now, I will say, I have a very hard time discussing this movie with any objectivity whatsoever. I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great time. I don't have anything to say negative about the movie. What did you like about it?
Well, it.
I notice I didn't say what didn't you like about it.
That assumes I liked it. Okay. I'm seeing. There are a lot of very interesting things in this movie. I'm thinking about the fact that, number one, it's a whale focused remake of the first movie.
Absolutely.
Essentially, the whales are going through their exact own V'ger plot, except, you know, the line that Spock says, you know, don't assume that everything that goes on in Earth has to do with humans. This is that same exact plot as the first movie, except not focused on humans, not based on humans, not for humans. Although, since humans fucked up, you know, it from happening properly in the first place, it is to them to fix it, which at the end they do. That whole scene at the very end when they're communicating with the probe, they may as well be having the same exact conversation about how, you know, they probably are having the same exact conversation that they had with V'ger at the end of the first movie, except we don't get to see the details because it's in whale language.
Right, it's in humpback whale language. I think that's a really astute reading of the movie. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, Star Trek IV is about perhaps making some sort of atonement for the motion picture. Because, yeah, the probe at the beginning is very similar to V'ger and what V'ger was doing.
Mm-hmm.
The whale portions, especially at the end, as you point out, you know, we don't know what they're saying. And you know, it's sort of a lot. What I think one of the things I like about the movie is that it, and what I liked about, I think, The Wrath of Khan, too, is that it took a lot of the best concepts from the motion picture and just sort of got rid of the interminable pacing and sort of the glacial nature of the movie. And the later Star Trek movies are really, really good at setup and execution, and they don't spend a ton of time on explanation, which is fine with me because they're great movies. And really it doesn't matter.
That's it. We see enough of this probe to know that it looks nothing like any other ship we've ever seen, to know that it has this completely accidentally destructive nature to it. It's just this force, and it's this... One of the things about V'ger is they are they find out more and more about it, it becomes a little more comprehensible, and at the end it's just, oh, it's just a Voyager probe that got, you know, programmed weird. We never really find out what this is, and so it is this shadowy threat the entire movie, which is interesting because that it keeps being threatening. We never find out the nature of it. We never understand it.
Yeah.
There's some theories about it and, you know, that they float around, and we have no reason other to assume that it was somehow in touch with whales and that it has been sent to check up on the whales. Beyond that, it doesn't, as you said, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and I think that goes with the theme of the movie, which, I mean, this is the only Star Trek movie that doesn't really have a villain, right? Like an actual villain.
Yeah.
It's one where there's no real violence to speak of. And, well, really the only violence is against the whales, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And I think that kind of fits with it because, you know, if you can talk about what the movie is about more than anything else, as much as this is a movie about anything, you know, whales were a large topic of conversation in the 80s. You know,
yeah, this is at the beginning of the environmental movement being huge.
In some ways, this movie, you know, it's interesting because I think this movie could have aged very poorly, but I think it's to its credit that it has aged well, and that a lot of the messages of, you know, endangered species and unintended consequences, we don't know what's going to happen if these species become endangered, that, you know, the sort of obtuse nature of the probe is the same thing as the obtuse, you know, problem of endangered species, right? Like it's a bad thing to kill off species, you know, just because not only because we don't know what they can provide for us, but because we don't know what else is out there. Right.
That's the one thing, the lesson of the movie can be taken to be a little too literally, as in don't destroy the whales or else what if there's an alien probe that's going to come back and want the whales. And, you know, that's obviously, you know,
I mean, I guess, I think...
And I recognize, you know, we have to take it more symbolically. That said, the movie almost... It goes along with a lot of Star Trek's optimism in that it sees the 80s San Francisco as kind of a shithole. Everybody's swearing, they're about to kill off whales, there's this weird bureaucracy nightmare. Like, it's primitive, the medical technology is more or less dark ages. The 80s are a terrible time as far as Star Trek is concerned. Given the values of the Federation, that makes sense. There would be a lot that they would see barbaric in the 80s. And yet, this more than anything, by directly showing a bad part of Earth's history and saying this is in the past, which was, of course, the present, the movie suggests that we can transcend them. It may take a while of mistakes, but we will be able to atone for them, and eventually, I mean, they make it very clear that whales will be repopulated. They are going to be, with the marine biologist leading a team of Federation scientists, there will be more whales.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point because, you know, we're 30 years out from this movie now almost, and this is, you know, if you look at this from, it's, you can look at this from two points of view, right? You can look at this from the point of view of someone who was watching this in 1986,
yeah,
and being directly confronted with, you know, a movie saying, wow, your time period is incredibly shitty, and you have a lot of shitty people running around, and you have a lot of shitty laws,
yeah,
and you have a lot of shitty societal problems. Or you can look at it from the point of view of someone living in our decade and say, well, the 80s were shitty and they had a lot of shitty people running around and they had a lot of shitty problems.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but at the same time, I don't think that you can pat yourself on the back and, you know, really look at this movie in any sort of, you know, objective way, because a lot of the same problems that people had in 1986 are still here, and perhaps maybe they're even worse. I mean, you know, it was just reported a couple months ago that, you know, Iceland is starting to whale again, you know, in Japan, whaling is growing again. And so these are cyclical problems yeah. that we have not overcome yet. And if you can come back to this movie, and I think that's one of the strengths of the movie is that, you know, I look forward to a time in the future when this movie is seen as a historical curiosity. I don't think that you can look at this movie that way.
Yeah. I mean, whales may not be, save the whales is not a catchphrase like it was at this time, but it's also the reason that it's whales in this movie is they had to pick a species. And that was one everybody knew was endangered, that there were a lot of conversations around. It could be that a condor. It could be, you know, it could be anything that's slightly furry and that we kind of like.
I mean, I think, you know, the picking whales is, you know, on a script level, it's dramatically interesting.
Yes, that's another reason too. What I'm saying is they represent any endangered species yeah. and species still are endangered through human efforts.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if they had gone back in time and needed a couple polar bears, I think we would have had a much more boring movie, right?
Of course.
They just go to the Antarctica and now they don't have, you know, it's like that. There's no movie there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, before we, you know, I want to talk more about this, but, you know, I want to go back to the beginning of the movie because.
Yeah, I remembered the whale plot, but it's funny that that's almost, it's a plot device more than a plot because the entire, and I hadn't seen Wrath of Khan or Search for Spock at this point. So the whole overarching plot, this is kind of the three do form a loose trilogy. And actually not even loose. It is a trilogy.
No, it's, yeah, I would say it's a very,
yeah, it is. They take place probably within a year of each other, right?
No, more than that. I mean, it's like 3 months.
Yeah. 6 months, 6 months then maybe, because they mentioned it's
not even,
it's like, 3 months.
It's like, it's like 3.5 months.
Okay.
Like it's a really quick time frame.
Okay, and they are directly dealing with consequences of stuff that happened.
Because they say in this movie that they had been exiled on Vulcan for 3 months.
Yes.
Like, explicitly said that in the movie. Which I thought was weird, because that's kind of like an admiral in the U.S. Navy being exiled in California. Like, I just don't understand fundamentally how that works. But, okay, for the purposes of the movie, I guess it doesn't really matter.
The sense, because they're talking about extraditing Kirk. I mean, they're not going to.
No. The Klingons.
Yes, I remember that. It could be as simple as they're not going to put him under armed custody. They are. I would assume he's surrendering. They aren't really arresting Kirk, which I would assume there would be a. Do you remember that the court martial where they say, you know, a Federation officer has never been court-martialed before? They are not going to take Captain Kirk home in chains. So they're probably arranging that. It's probably a self-imposed exile on Vulcan. They are not going to. He's out on bail until his trial is. I assumed it was more like that. It's just they want to know where he is at all times, and he's not really going to be exploring the galaxy in those 3 months.
Well, I think there's a couple of interesting things there, right? Because, you know, last week you had said, you know, we're going to find out why Kirk isn't in space jail, right? And we do find out why Kirk isn't in space jail. He's not in space jail because of the reason you just said. The other thing I think is interesting is that you also had issues with the search for Spock in that you weren't really sure who was giving orders. And
yes.
I think in this movie, we see very explicitly, I mean, for the first time, we see a Federation president.
Yeah, I noticed that.
We see the Federation Council. And, you know, what you think of the structure of how the Federation government is exactly set up and the checks and balances between the Federation, you know, civilian government and Starfleet and blah, blah, blah. It's, you know,
yeah.
It's Star Trek has always been very loose with that. And it's
I'm not sure it matters.
Exactly. It doesn't really matter. But I'm curious what you thought of the opening scene with the Federation Council, because I think that's kind of what you were asking for, and I knew it was coming, and
yeah,
you
well,
got it.
Here's the interesting thing. When Star Trek the Motion Picture came out, it was very much trying to be Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It was very much trying to be 2001. This is a post-Dune and a post-Return of the Jedi movie, very much. Like, the beginning sequences feel like Star Trek doing Star Wars. You have all these weird aliens. You have these weird planets, more so than we've seen before. I don't know. There was a little – it was a little more Muppety, I think, which is not necessarily bad, but tonally it does feel like a different shift. Again, it makes complete sense why. The science fiction film had changed very much in what that phrase meant, I think. Again, this is a post Star Wars Star Trek movie.
Yeah. At the same time, I think it does, you know, you can hand wave away, you know, not having a wide variety of aliens on starships, but I don't think you can as easily hand wave away not having representatives from all the different alien species that are in the Federation at the Federation's governing body.
Yeah, and again, I liked it. I do like seeing weird aliens. I enjoyed all of those parts. I thought the pre-Earth scenes are fantastic. It's a very fun movie to watch. There's a lot of strange things going on.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, the movie is set up very economically as well, yeah. Because you really do get like sort of the housekeeping, and then they decide to fly back to Earth to turn themselves in, basically, Kirk and crew. And, you know, the probe comes, and the probe is causing issues, and Earth is basically, its oceans are boiling away, which certainly doesn't sound like a good time. And
No, everybody gets shrimp. That would be like the best soup in the world, man.
But, you know, so they decide to just quickly, oh, yeah, we're just going to go back. And one of the things I like about the movie the most is that it is just sort of insane. But I mean that in a very good way, and I mean that in a very loving way. You know, they all just sort of go with it, and they immediately come up with this idea, well, we're just going to slingshot around the sun, again, bringing up something
well,
that they
yeah,
did.
Yeah, that was my – I loved that because they – See, I'd seen this movie before as one of my first Star Trek things, and I thought that time travel was more prevalent. Like, I thought time travel was just a thing they did. And I didn't remember that they did it by slingshotting around the sun. I didn't know if, like, the Guardian of Forever is involved or something. But it's nice that they did it because I do buy that it's such an inexact science in a way, that it is so risky, that it is so... You know, both on a integrity of the ship and a, you know, fucking with history level. You know, I buy that they haven't done this before, but also, like, time travel is something that they save when Earth is about to boil away.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I think, if there was a time to use this as a last resort, this was it.
Well, I just think, you know, I think, yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think, you know, it's also nice... thematically, because it kind of comes full circle. And, you know, the previous two Star Trek movies, and the first one to some degree, you know, was about this crew getting older and feeling a little out of sorts, feeling a little bit like they were perhaps out of their own time and ready to retire and, you know, go to your robe and
yeah,
smoke a pipe. And the thing I like about this movie is that Earth is in trouble. No one can do anything about it. And they figure it out in like 3 minutes. And they're like, yeah, okay, it's whales. Cool. What should we do? Well, we could go back in time and bring some whales back. And
yeah,
they're just like, I just, you know, I've seen this movie enough that I don't really ever just sit back and think about the sheer audacity of the plot. But it's
it's
weird.
Ridiculous.
It is. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I mean, this is the movie that... Anytime the subject of Star Trek movies comes up, if you're not talking about Wrath of Khan, you're talking about this one. There's a reason for that. Wrath of Khan is just such a great movie. This is such a batshit movie. And I think it's memorable for that. I remember when we were talking about Phase 2, and, you know... We were talking about, well, if Phase 2 had been made, would Star Trek have been a thing? And you said, I think it would have just been in the 90s, one of those, you know, a 90s Star Trek movie. In a lot of ways, that's not that different from this movie. You know, put the Star Trek characters into the mid-90s and have it be a very terrible period piece. And that's probably what a campy 90s, you know, throwback Star Trek movie would have been. Here, because it's actually about something. It is about how the mistakes that we have made as a society can be fixed, and the ones that we are dealing with now, if this had been, I mean, I think about how Austin Powers is just a kooky fish out of water comedy. This would have been Austin Powers with the Star Trek crew.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of bewildering, but I'll go with that.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right. And I think the thing as well about the movie is when we were talking earlier about, you know, someone in 1986 watching this and just being berated over and over again by the fact that their decade sucked. You know, I think that the movie is and Star Trek, I think, in general is optimistic about the power of the individual and society as a whole to right itself and to fix itself. And I think this movie is very optimistic in saying, you know, this is a message movie in as much as Star Trek. This is probably the strongest message movie of any of the Star Trek movies. And this is explicitly saying to people in 1986, you can fix this.
I have a question, though. Are the eugenics wars about to start?
Yeah.
Like within maybe 5-10 years?
10 years. They should. I think they're supposed to start in 1996.
Okay. Well, then that
was it. 1994.
So pretty much most of the characters that they see incidentally are going to be dead in 10-15 years.
Well, you know, I mean, we don't want to talk about the eugenics wars. It's once we get out of the original series, they kind of just don't really mention it again.
Okay, so that punk is not going to be killed in the eugenics wars.
He probably will be.
Aww.
It's more that they elide the question of whether or not the eugenics wars actually happen.
So wait, what if the marine biologist causes the eugenics wars and then it doesn't happen because they took her out of the time stream?
That could be.
Huh.
That could be.
I like it as a trilogy because it gives a lot. There are a lot of very interesting arcs that mostly Kirk and Spock go through, but also the Enterprise goes through an arc, Earth grows through an arc. It's, I don't know, I think they actually managed to take the themes of Star Trek and spin them out into a more coherent and, frankly, more sophisticated way in this. I mean, you have Spock going through.
I've never heard someone call Star Trek 4 sophisticated, but okay.
But it is in its way, because even the first four movies, they represent Spock's journey from a being of pure logic to being somebody who embraces his human side. At the very beginning of the first Star Trek movie, he's being rejected from the Kolinar. He's being rejected to be a machine, and during the first movie, he recognizes that the value of friendship is one which does allow Kirk to, you know, to be stronger, does allow, you know, a being of pure logic to transcend and be the next step of it. The second movie, Spock dies and gets brought back to life as a blank slate in the third. In this movie, he's trying to become whole, really. He's going through this education at the beginning. He knows every single factual question. The question, how do you feel, completely eludes him.
Well, I think, you know, that's interesting because I wanted to talk about that scene between Spock and his mother.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important scene in the movie that generally goes unremarked upon by a lot of people for whatever reason, I don't know. And it's a really interesting scene because they're basically, I mean, it's she is coming to him and saying, you know, look, you're half human. The computer knows that. That's why it's asking you this question. And, you know, you need to be able to answer that question, basically. And
yeah.
I think Spock being given another lease on life has, in a way, provided him with the opportunity to better integrate his human and Vulcan halves.
Yes.
Because I think, you know, especially in the original series, he very much was trying to be the Uber Vulcan. And if you can say anything about the movies, it's that after his death and resurrection, he is trying, I think, to understand his human friends a little more. And even to the point where, you know, McCoy is needling him a lot in this movie, but he doesn't really rise to the bait as much as he used to. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that he's understanding McCoy a little better.
Yeah, that is.
And also because he's been in McCoy's head.
Yeah, and McCoy has also, I think he's recognizing why McCoy teases people. McCoy is not afraid to speak his mind, to tell his friends when he's disappointed with them. When Kirk messes up, McCoy is usually the first one to say, "Dude, do you see what you just did?" I think Spock's beginning to realize that that is a way that McCoy shows affection in a way. Like, I think
take that a step further. I think Spock is starting to understand the concept of affection.
That actually makes a lot of sense too.
Yeah.
But I think by the end of this, this trilogy or tetralogy, depending on whether you want to put the first movie in there or not, because it does, I would say it picks up on themes from the first movie rather than actively incorporating the first movie's plot. It's about how these characters achieve integrity in a way. And Spock doesn't get to do that until he has at least understood some of his humanity. I mean, the very end of the movie, he says, you know, "Tell my mother I feel fine." I mean, that's the last line of it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it is a very deliberate callback to the question, you know, the one question he couldn't answer was the question that a human could answer. But the fact that he's saying "I feel fine" is a way of, he has achieved wholeness. I think it's very important that that scene, that Kirk was able to witness that scene between Spock and his father. I think Spock has seen some of Savick having emotions and benefiting from them. I don't know. Kirk's journey in this is to not be embarrassed by his emotions and not to reject his emotions. He's never going to cry in front of people. He is never going to let his feelings sway what he thinks is a logical decision. He's not going to, you know, break down in front of everything. But when a guess needs to be made, he can now do that.
Yeah.
At the very end, he only manages to get them back home because he guesses. That's kind of a quandary. And it's, you know, for him, he's hitting this block. And it is McCoy who says, "Well, just guess." And it's crazy enough to work. But embracing that human doubt is what allows Spock to go further in his life, to make the next step in his development as a Vulcan, as a person.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Kirk is dealing with how does he stay relevant as he gets older, and how he sometimes
I think it's funny that we're talking about how Kirk stays relevant as he gets older when he has just saved Earth from total destruction.
I mean that's basically it. It's funny because we keep talking. I mean, my question is why Kirk got promoted to admiral. Why did he take the promotion? Do they make that clear?
No, they never really do. And
I wonder if it's even as simple as, you know, admiral is a very important, prominent position, and I think Kirk might have liked the spotlight for a little while. But his arc through this is to, again, at the beginning of Wrath of Khan, one of the first things Bones says to him is, you know, "Get your captaincy back." You know, at the end, he is demoted to captain. He is, it's weird, but by holding himself back slightly, Kirk manages to thrive.
Yeah.
He is not an admiral. He is not, that's not where he will thrive. He goes crazy in that position.
And that's a great scene at the end of the movie where they dismiss all the charges and they say basically, "Look, you're going to be a captain again because you have demonstrated that you are a captain." And not only that, we're giving you the Enterprise back.
Yeah, that was a very lovely when they, you know, "Oh, is it going to be the Excelsior?" And you see they've rebuilt the Enterprise. And, you know, they give, it's kind of a punishment, but, you know, because it's done as a demotion, but he's...
Well, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. They need to give an official demotion, but that's what he wants. Then, yeah. You know, it's the best of all worlds.
I think it's interesting because one of the criticisms of these, you know, the trilogy here, the, you know, 2, 3, and 4, is that I've always had a somewhat of a problem with, is that these really represent the reset switch in Star Trek, and that, you know, the second movie was daring and, you know, Spock dies and all these changes happen, and, you know, then the next two movies they spent basically erasing all of that and getting back to the status quo. And sure, on one hand, I can accept that as an argument, but I think it just totally, as we've just, you know, talked about for the past few minutes, I think that argument completely ignores all of the real characterization and sort of emotional arcs of these characters. And it's not about getting them back to where they were because they want to make more Star Trek movies. It's more about having a respect for these characters and really showing how they're growing as they're getting older.
Well, I would even go further and say that the entire theme of the trilogy is about checking growth. After a while, Division becomes cancer. I mean, you have Khan who gets his starship, has the Genesis device, is told, you can get away scot-free now, you've won, but he doesn't, you know, I need to conquer Kirk, and that becomes his undoing. In the third movie, the very literal, that Genesis device, the growth of it is literally destroying the planet. Christopher Lloyd's character going, you know, in his ambition, you know, destroys himself. In this movie, you have humanity's greed. It's explicitly called greed to killing the whales, which ends up destroying almost destroying the Earth. The entire thing is saying, figure out the point where you belong.
Yeah.
Before it's too late, and stay there. There is not going to be any benefit to... I don't want to say the movies are suggesting you don't reach beyond your grasp, but I think they are more saying find out where you're whole and find out what really does make you whole.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think it's interesting too because, you know, some of the, and we'll talk about the Doctor character in a couple minutes because I'm sure we both want to talk about her, but... You know, I think you can see that in the smaller characters as well. I think you can see that in Sulu and Uhura and Scotty and not McCoy necessarily, but, you know, because Sulu doesn't do a lot in this movie, but what he does is fly a helicopter, which I think is interesting. Scotty and McCoy go off on a little, you know, side mission.
That scene, by the way. The whole transparent aluminum at the factory scene, probably my favorite scene in the movie and one of my favorite Star Trek scenes. That guy who is the plant manager is not only perfectly cast, his costuming, that little button that says I quit smoking, just that's the entire character right there. That is who that person is, and that is a brilliant detail. The way that Scotty and McCoy are playing off of each other, that was hilarious.
Yeah. I've read criticism of that scene that it kind of makes Scotty into too much of a buffoon because, you know, he wouldn't talk to the computer. And it's like,
oh, that was hilarious.
I don't know. I mean, if I was confronted with like a cotton gin, would I know how to use it? I mean, that's basically the level of technology he's working with here.
I also think it's hilarious because Scotty is this genius mechanic who can, you know, figure anything out immediately. And the fact that he, you know, he is so used to a voice input that he doesn't even think. And I just love his look of when he's handed the mouse and he uses it at the microphone. Like, he has this look of mild embarrassment, like, oh, I'm being an idiot. I'm not talking into the microphone. like that was what he was doing wrong. And he's almost amused at the primitive computer that needs a microphone. Like, I loved that.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course that's a theme throughout the movie. I think everybody talks about that at some point. And I mean, you know, the most famous example of that and probably the most fun example of that, of course, is, you know, after they, you know, Chekhov gets hit in the head or whatever happens to him and they have to go rescue him at the hospital, that, you know, McCoy gets a couple of great moments to just show complete disgust at the level of medicine in the 20th century.
He has a pill that can completely cure an 80-year-old woman's failed kidneys as like part of his regular medical kit. Like, it's not even like he has to find it.
Right. He's just ready with it.
It's like an aspirin to him. And I love that scene when she's like, they're all like, you know, following her with clipboards. And she's just like, I got a new kidney. It's a miracle.
I think it's interesting because, you know, one of the things about the movie is that, you know, the 80s sections are, I mean, they're just extremely entertaining. And of course, fish out of water stuff is always fun to watch. You know, I don't know that there's much there thematically, at least. I think it's just a good excuse to put these characters in different situations that we have never seen them in before.
Yeah, it's a very broad, in a lot of ways, it's a very broad movie, especially in those scenes, and they are going very big with it. But yeah, it's funny.
It's absolutely funny. And I do think that we get a sense of the 80s, especially in the character of you know, Dr. Jillian Taylor. She is one of the emotional, you know, linchpins of the whole movie. And she provides a lot of the, well, she's basically our analog in this movie, right?
She is the general 20th century professional person.
Right. And but I like her because, you know, she's a character in Star Trek that we don't get enough, which is sort of this, you know, no nonsense, just woman. I mean, I think it's not incidental that she's a woman.
It's weird because it is and it isn't. Like, they don't. She is definitely a woman. She is definitely a love interest, but they don't make any, you know, the fact it's not quite, you know, that she is in a, you know, in a specific position in this institute, that she has, that she is a scientist, that she has a high degree of intelligence. That's not even, that's all taken for granted.
Yeah.
Like, it's not questioned. And by this
point, I think in terms of the way that the characterization between her and Kirk is written and shot, I think it's completely different from how something like this would have been written and shot during the original series. And there's no overt sexualization of the character. She's not, they don't ever really make any sort of explicit sexual or romantic overtones to each other. There is that one scene in the pizza place, but that's,
you know,
they
flirt through the whole movie pretty much, you can tell, but it's also as much based on the fact that they enjoy each other's company, that they recognize that each other is very, that each other is very passionate and dedicated to their job and very competent and very, you know, intelligent. And they respect each other from the get-go. They like each other as people, and that's very clear. You know, yes, there is an attraction between them, but it's a partnership of equals in this.
Yeah, and I think it's rare for Kirk to find someone who can keep up with him.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily think that she even keeps up with him. I think that she surpasses him. I mean, you know, let's not forget that at the very end of the movie, he's going to leave her. And she said, well, no, I want to go with you.
And what's interesting especially is at the very end, she ends up leaving him, basically, like when you think, oh, well, she wants to be with the captain. She very much says, I have nothing. I'm with the whales. You know, that's my life. If I don't have whales, you know, she, you know, let's not forget, if she doesn't have the star attraction at her exhibit, what is she doing with her job? She doesn't really have much to do. And so, you know, you think, well, she's going to join and she's going to stay with Kirk, but they, at the end of the day, she's basically saying, well, look, number one, this is a lost science to you people, and I know it. You know, I get to teach you everything. And then, you know, she says, I have 300 years of catch up to do. As a scientist, she's going to have the time of her life. This is pretty much as much of a gift as any scientist could ask. And while he's a little sad about it, it doesn't seem like he begrudges her that opportunity at all, because it completely makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the end of that is maybe the one false note in the movie, you know, just because of the fact that she made such a point of saying, well, you guys don't have any whale experts and I'm the only one and you guys don't know what to do or what, you know, and then she just basically packs up and leaves on a science vessel, and it's like, oh, okay.
I may even assume that they would take this, you know, they would go to a planet where they would make more whales.
What?
I would assume they would take it to the whale, a planet to make whales. Like, why would they make the whales on Earth? Earth is polluted, but I don't know.
Earth isn't polluted.
Well,
Earth is fine.
Oh, really? Well, good for Earth.
That's like the 23rd century, dude. Earth is fine.
See, I mean, if they could. There, I guess there really is no way she can see the galaxy and take care of the whales.
Right.
And
I mean, I guess, you know, you can sort of hand wave that away by saying, well, why do they need to take care of whales, right? Like, the whales will be fine.
Yeah, she can probably spend she probably is going to spend several months on an intensive, all right, here's whale biology.
She can write her whale biology book on a spaceship.
Yeah. Exactly. She's going to be able to virtually train people. She's probably given them the salient. I mean, put it this way. There were zookeepers at this point in the 23rd century. It's not going to be hard to teach them to take care of another type of animal. They've taken care of, you know, giant mammals before from other planets.
What I find interesting about her character is that in a lot of ways, she is a modern version of Edith Keeler from The City on the Edge of Forever.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
And I think that they both recognize that, you know, what I like about it is that they find her. And I think Kirk and Spock both immediately pick up on the fact that if not consciously realize that she's very much like Edith Keeler, that she is someone who they can talk to.
Yeah.
And that she is someone who feels out of place in her own time, feels like things are not going well, that things should be going better, that humans can do more. And that she's a perfect example of that. She's dedicated her life to taking care of animals that are hunted mercilessly by people. And she realizes that in a way, I think that she realizes that as well, because why else would she go after them?
Yeah. And in some ways, I'm actually reminded of the secretary from that terrible Mission Earth or whatever episode. Because both the marine biologist and the secretary, and again, I am forgetting their names completely, I think it's both interesting that they, when they are confronted with actual evidence of aliens or time travelers or whatever, they don't really freak out so much as they are just fascinated by it. You know, again, you know, in this movie, when she gets on the ship, she's a little surprised. She doesn't, you know, the sensation of teleporting, you know, freaks her out a little bit, but she quickly gets over that. She is more entranced by the fact that, oh my God, I am on a spaceship from the future.
And I think there's a sense too in her mind that, you know, why would they lie about this? Like, what would they have to gain?
Well, you know, it's interesting because what seemed very funny to me at the beginning was when she sees them. You know, so she sees them on this tour. You know, they jump. You know, Spock jumps in with the whale. She thinks, okay, these are just two crazy San Francisco guys. And she sees them later. She very comfortably strikes up a conversation with them. She offers them a ride, you know, and she even, you know, she jokes like, oh, don't try anything funny, you know, about that. But she's not really worried about them.
Yeah, where were they going, by the way? Like,
I don't know. I got the sense that they were just, like, walking home, like, and hours later she saw them and she realized, oh, they're not even on a bus. Like, they're just, like, walking.
They ran out of money.
Yeah. I mean, she buys the story about Spock just, you know, did a little too much acid in the 60s very easily. Well, again, she's in San Francisco. She, you know, around by the beach. How many of these people does she see a day? I think she does recognize that even though they may be crazy, they're harmless, and they're just two guys that... And then later you find out that she is very, very lonely. She's willing to... She gives no real culture shock about the fact that she is in the 23rd century. She does not seem to... The only person she really interacts with is her boss, who she doesn't really care about. She doesn't have any family to miss. She doesn't really have... Her only friends are whales. And I don't know. There is something poignant about the fact that she gives a ride to two burnouts that have nice faces.
Yeah, and I think that says something nice about the future as presented by Star Trek as well, because this is a future where someone who can come from 300 years in the past and just immediately feel comfortable, immediately feel at home, you know, everything is working, you know, the trains run on time. I mean, you know, all these things are just, it's a nice future. And I think that she recognizes that fairly quickly. I think that she recognizes the fundamental goodness of these people and realizes that they're here to help, really, I mean, for no gain other than to save their planet. They're not here for money. They're not here for power. They're not here for anything that she would recognize in, you know, people of her own time. And I also don't think it's incidental. I mean, let's put this in historical context. You know, we talked about sort of some of the Save the Whales stuff that was prevalent at this time period. There's also some talk about nuclear power. And, you know, we see her truck has, like, I think her license plate said something about whale lover, and she's got bumper stickers.
Yeah.
You know, let's not forget nuclear power was a big issue in the 80s. And, you know, we're also talking about sort of the re-escalation of the Cold War in some respects in this time period. And I think she realizes that the man who was followed around by a guy in a robe who calls him Admiral is an admiral in some sort of Navy,
yeah,
which she would realize as a military organization. I think that goes a long way, maybe subconsciously, maybe not, towards her own understanding of what exactly she's getting into and the kind of future that these people come from.
Well, she does think that, and at one point, you know, she thinks that he is from the government or something, and he wants the, you know, but when she says, like, you're not going to use them for some, like, kind of weapons thing, and he says no, like, she believes him. And she is a very trusting
person. No dipshit stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. She's a very trusting person, but, you know, we of course know that Kirk is trustworthy.
I think her loneliness goes into that somewhat, though, because I think that she wants to find someone to help her.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't think she's a bad judge of character.
No, that's it. She wants to believe this. Here's a guy who says, I'm going to treat your whales well and give you, you know, give them the perfect thing. And she knows this is literally, you know, she has been praying for a stranger to drop in with a solution to her problems. But she is also, put it this way, a single woman living in San Francisco in 1986. And it's probably really hard to bullshit her. And of course, she knows that, well, this is a guy who's crazy. And he's probably did a little too much LDS in the 60s, too. And, you know, she's not going to believe him. She's hanging out with him as much as she has nothing better to do that night. She wants to go to dinner with somebody, and he's entertaining enough. You know, why not? She'll answer his question. She'll go along with it as long as it doesn't hurt anything. When she drops him off, she doesn't, you know, immediately believe him, and she doesn't immediately help him. And it isn't until she finds that the whales have been already moved and that she literally is at the end of her rope that she figures, all right, I literally have nothing to lose. When she still has something to lose, she doesn't completely trust him.
That is true, yeah.
Which I do feel speaks well for her because, she isn't naive. She's trusting but not naive. And that's another thing that Edith Keeler is, because let's face it, she literally ran a bit. Her literal job was taking in crazy bums off the street who had substance abuse problems. That was what she did for a living. That was what she did every single day. And so, again, both of them have an open mind, have compassion for people who may be down on their luck or who may not be, who are on the outs of society in some way.
Yeah, yeah. We haven't really talked too much about, you know, some of those sort of side quests that happened in the movie. And there's not too much to talk about, but I did have one question for you about them. And that is, do you think that they are all as effective as each other? Or
can
we get rid of some of them?
All entertaining things to watch. I liked the Uhura and Chekhov things were a little more adventure-y because, you know, they're sneaking around the factory and, you know, Chekhov gets captured, and they were funny because, again, that scene where to have a Russian in 1986 asking where nuclear power is and just to have a cop look at, just staring at him is hilarious because, again, you are in the Cold War, you know, a Russian asking about where nuclear waste is probably about as cartoonish a character of a boogeyman as you can get at that point in time. Like, that was funny. Again, the Scotty and McCoy scenes were hilarious. I don't necessarily find anything I would take out.
I think they could have done a better job explaining what exactly Sulu was doing.
What was Sulu doing?
He was flying a helicopter, and I think he was...
he was getting the helicopter to put the transparent aluminum on the ship.
Right. Right. So I think they could have explained that a little better.
Well, when the shots had the helicopter carrying the stuff down, I assume he was just renting it.
But he was wearing a kicky turquoise jumpsuit, so...
He and the helicopter pilot got it on, though. You know that was what was happening.
Sulu's not gay.
Well, he was all like, you know, so tell me about your helicopter. Does it spin around? And like, you know, the guy's like, oh, I've got a cockpit. And like, you know, you know they boned after.
All right. I just hope they use protection because it was San Francisco in 1986.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
Finally, and perhaps most importantly, where do you think that the movies are going?
Honestly, I do tiny bits, but it's so complete at the end here. What worries me is because this arc is completed, this is a trilogy in itself, and it ends with them having the Enterprise and they can do whatever. I would assume that the next couple are a little more just the I would assume they would have to work hard to get out of the Enterprise goes on another adventure type of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no, I don't know where to go.
Okay, well, I think where we can go, if we have nothing else to say about The Voyage Home.
Didn't you say Yeoman Rand was in it?
Yes, I did. She was in it.
Where?
How do you miss this all the time?
I don't know, because they don't have a sign that says, hey, it's Yeoman Rand. I need that.
You have eyes.
Yeah, I know.
You know what she looks like.
I know what her hair looks like.
Oh, my God. Nurse Chapel was in it, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Where?
I'll show you after we're done.
No, it's not going to matter. It just doesn't matter. I give this movie 8 whales. I'm sorry, do you not want me to use whales as a...
It gets 8 million whales.
But that would be lovely for the marine biologist, because everywhere she goes, she would meet one whale.
That would be nice.
Aww.
I wish we saw her again, but we never do.
Oh, well, yeah, because she's on this. And but at the end, by the way, they're just like, oh, we'll never talk to each other. It's like, there's no communications. Like, yes, they can't date every single day, but they can at least talk.
They could have Skype sex.
They could. Ew.
Well, on that note, we will see you next week. For Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
I'm excited.
You shouldn't be.